Today is Friday, July 23rd, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinyere for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. House of Representatives votes to admit Afghans who helped American forces.
With the U.S. withdrawal in its final weeks, the bill's sponsor, Democrat Jason Crow, said haste was essential.
Plus, Iraqi delegation seeks end of U.S. combat missions in Iraq.
U.S. withdrew troops at the end of the Iraq War in 2011. But after Islamic State's resurgence across Iraq in 2014, American forces returned.
Also, Tokyo Olympics opened today amid COVID-19. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. The U.S. military launched several airstrikes this week in support of Afghan government forces fighting Taliban insurgents, including in the strategically important province of Kandahar. U.S. officials on Thursday said the strikes demonstrates U.S. intentions to continue supporting Afghan forces with combat aircraft based outside the country, at least until the U.S. military completes its withdrawal on August 31st. The Biden administration has not said whether it will continue that support after the pullout is complete. The U.S. has a variety of combat aircraft based in the Middle East within range of Afghanistan, including planes aboard an aircraft carrier in the region and fighters and bombers in the Persian Gulf area. The House has voted to allow thousands more of the Afghans who worked alongside Americans in the Afghanistan war enter into the United States. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
The yeas are 407 and the nays are 16.
The vote was overwhelming, but Republican Congressman Tom McClintock was unhappy with the measure.
I will support this bill as the least bad option.
He said it would set up a hasty and inadequate screening process. But with the U.S. withdrawal in its final weeks, the bill's sponsor, Democrat Jason Crow, said haste was essential.
The threat to our Afghan partners who served alongside American men and women is increasing drastically every single day.
Congressman Neil Dunn, a veteran of the Vietnam War, recalled leaving allies behind.
It still weighs on me.
The Florida Republican said the U.S. must not do it again.
Please do not abandon friends of America. Again,
the measure adds 8,000 more visas to the 26,500 already allocated. Ben Thomas, Washington.
The Taliban say they don't want to monopolize power, but they insist there won't be peace in Afghanistan until there's a new negotiated government in Kabul and President Ashraf Ghani is removed. In an interview with the Associated Press, Suhail Shaheen, who is also a member of the negotiating team, laid out the insurgent stance on what should come next in the country. The Taliban has swiftly captured territory in recent weeks, seized strategic border crossings, and are threatening a number of provincial capitals as the last U.S. and NATO troops leave Afghanistan. When the Taliban held power in the 1990s, it did not tolerate much political dissent and was known for repressing women and minority groups under a strict interpretation of Islam. That history has many Afghans concerned about a future Taliban-dominated government. Members of a top Iraqi delegation in Washington say they expect to reach an agreement with the Biden administration to end the U.S. combat missions in Iraq. The comments come ahead of Prime Minister Mustafa El-Kadhimi's summit with President Joe Biden. White House correspondent Patsy Widas-Kuwara has this report.
Suicide bomb ripped through the Iraqi capital this week, killing at least 34 people. The attack, claimed by the Islamic State, is the kind of violence that Iraqi forces, trained and equipped by the United States, are trying to deter. U.S. support is expected to continue and will be a key focus in Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Hadimi's meeting with President Joe Biden at the White House, said Press Secretary Jen Psaki, responding to VOA.
Their government is requesting continuing support from us in the coalition for training and enabling its forces, logistics, intelligence sharing, and other areas of security cooperation.
The U.S. withdrew troops at the end of the Iraq War in 2011. But after Islamic State's resurgence across Iraq and Syria in 2014, American forces returned. In April, U.S. and Iraq agreed to transition American troops' mission to focus on training and advisory, allowing for the redeployment of combat soldiers from Iraq. An agreement on ending the U.S. combat mission is expected to be finalized on Friday, said Iraqi Foreign Prime Minister Fuad Hussein in an interview with VOA's Kurdish service.
But how will they not remain, and when do they exit, is related to a timeline agreed on by both sides, as well as technical matters and other issues related to the security of the forces.
While Baghdad is eager to show it can handle its own security, Iranian-backed militia groups have been targeting U.S. and Iraqi troops with drone and rocket attacks. The Iraqi government is also facing pressure from Iranian-linked political factions pushing for American troops to leave. But Baghdad needs U.S. military support to maintain stability. Natasha Hall is senior fellow with the Middle East program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
So that points to more public statements saying that Iraq is ready and requiring U.S. military withdrawal or at least combat troops to disappear. On the U.S. side, it's actually pretty much the same. There's definitely a goal on behalf of the Biden administration to pivot away from the Middle East, to push it down in the list of priorities as well.
About 2,500 American soldiers remain in Iraq, and a shift in their role may not necessarily mean a reduction in numbers, but a formal announcement on ending their combat mission can be seen as a political win for Khadimi ahead of the Iraqi parliamentary elections scheduled for October. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
The United States is seeking, quote, a reliable, predictable, and constructive way to secure progress in stalled nuclear arms talks with North Korea, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman said on Friday. Sherman made the remarks after meeting with South Korean Vice Foreign Minister Choi Jong-kun in Seoul on the second leg of her Asian tour. The two discussed how to reopen negotiations after North Korea brushed up the Biden administration's proposals for talks, casting a cloud over prospects of dismantling its nuclear and missile programs. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has said the food situation was, quote, tense, unquote, citing the pandemic that led to North Korea closing its border with China, disrupting trade, and a typhoon last year that damaged crops. Sherman, who has considerable experience in dealing with North Korea, said the United States had offered to, quote, sit and dialogue, unquote.
We have offered to sit in dialogue with the North Koreans, and we're waiting to hear from them. And as he also said, we all feel for the people of the DPRK, who are indeed facing all of the most difficult circumstances given the pandemic and what it means as well for their food security. We only hope for a better outcome for the people of the DPRK. Relationship with China is obviously a complicated one. It has aspects that are competitive, it has aspects where it is challenging, and aspects where we can cooperate. And thinking together about bringing the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, certainly an area for cooperation.
That's U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman. Human rights and media rights groups have expressed outrage over revelations that 180 journalists around the world were targeted for surveillance by military-grade Israeli spyware. VOA senior diplomatic correspondents in the same reports on a widening scandal, with some world leaders also targeted, such as French President Emmanuel Macron.
Fallout is mounting from revelations that the private Israeli company NSO Group sold its Pegasus surveillance software to governments around the world. Some used it to target journalists and human rights activists, and even government leaders, including French President Emmanuel Macron. Macron has called for an investigation, and Israel says it is appointing a task force to investigate. NSO says the spyware is intended to help catch criminals and terrorists. But an international investigation, started by Paris-based Forbidden Stories and Amnesty International, known as the Pegasus Project, found that the spyware has been used extensively by a cluster of 10 countries to target journalists and activists, penetrating their cell phones and even taking over their phones' cameras. Lauren Richard of Forbidden Stories spoke with VOA.
You have Saudi Arabia, Azerbaijan, Mexico, Morocco. All those countries are well known to have some behavior against journalists, against human rights defenders. They are tracking them. In Mexico, we find the phone number of a journalist appearing in the list, and 2 months later, he was killed. We were able also to prove that the fiancé of Jamal Khashoggi was surveilled by that software right after the killing of Jamal Khashoggi.
One of the journalists targeted in Rwanda worked for VOA. A journalist targeted by Azerbaijan, Sevij Vajigazi, told VOA her privacy has been destroyed.
From now on, you know that wherever you are, someone is with you, watching you, seeing you, recording your conversations, determining your whereabouts, wherever you go or do something. You are under someone's control, and they can see and record everything about you, whether you are sleeping, standing, going to the kitchen, or even going to the bathroom.
An Azerbaijani activist and blogger, Bakhtiyar Hajiyev, has been imprisoned and beaten in his home country on charges of evading military service. The Pegasus investigation confirmed that his phone number was on the list of targets. He told VOA Wednesday he is constantly threatened. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Condemning Tigrayan forces and praising the filling of a major dam project, thousands rallied in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa on Thursday in support of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
Thousands filled the streets of Addis Ababa on Thursday, showing their opposition to Ethiopia's opponents both inside and outside its borders. Some carried signs condemning the Tigray People's Liberation Front, whose forces the federal military has been fighting in the country's north, as a cancer. Others commended Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed for filling the $4 billion US Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. That move has angered Egypt and Sudan, who fear the dam's impact on their access to Nile waters. Speaking at the rally, Addis Mayor Adonech Abebe told the crowd, "This is our time."
Enemies from within and historical enemies from outside are scared of our reforms and are working together and tirelessly to disturb our sovereignty, to disrupt our national unity and our journey to prosperity.
Abiy has faced international criticism for his handling of the Tigray conflict. But in the capital, businessman Tezros Bekele said the United Nations should take its hands off Ethiopia.
"Nothing can stop Ethiopia. Our unity will continue. Ethiopia will not fall."
Meanwhile, Tigrayan forces have seized three districts in a neighboring Afar region and sent more than 54,000 people fleeing from their homes. That's according to an Afar regional spokesman on Thursday, who said, quoting some of the displaced people, Tigrayan fighters had burned homes, looted, and killed civilians. He provided no evidence and his claims could not be independently verified. Getachew Reda, spokesman for the Tigrayan forces, did not immediately return calls seeking comment on the accusations.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. This is the Voice of America. Thousands of Eritrean refugees are increasingly caught in the middle of the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Witnesses and UN officials say forces have attacked their camps, abducted or killed some of the residents, and stolen their food and possessions. Refugees are among the most vulnerable groups in the Tigray conflict. Prisoners inside Myanmar's most notorious jail reportedly held a protest, singing popular songs opposing the military government and chanting political slogans. One video posted to social media showed a street close to Insein prison in Yangon with clear sound of voices shouting support for ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi and ousted president Win Myint. A typhoon is forecast to bring heavy rains to Taiwan and coastal China over the next few days, even as central China struggles to recover from the worst flooding on record. Typhoon Infai is expected to make landfall in the coastal province of Zhejiang either Sunday afternoon or early Monday morning. Zhejiang and Fujian province to the south issued warnings about the typhoon. The forecast follows flooding earlier this week in the central province of Henan, where record rains pushed rivers and reservoirs over their banks. At least 33 people died in the flood. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. After a one-year pandemic delay, the Tokyo Olympics on Friday formally got underway. The opening ceremony was scaled back while still celebratory, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports.
The opening ceremony in Tokyo will be held amid tens of thousands of empty seats in Tokyo's Olympic Stadium. Only about 900 dignitaries and other officials will attend because of COVID-19 precautions. The ceremony, themed United by Emotion, may be one of the most normal elements of what figures to be the most unusual Olympic Games ever. The ceremony will feature familiar features such as fireworks, drones, musical performances, and a torch lighting ceremony. Athletes will also march and wave their country's flags during a socially distanced parade of nations. Hidemasa Nakamura, a Tokyo 2020 organizing committee official, says a minimum of 1 meter and possibly 2 meters of social distancing is required during the parade, and athletes must wear masks at all times. The Japanese public is broadly opposed to holding the games, fearing they will worsen Japan's already deteriorating pandemic situation. Tokyo on Thursday reported nearly 2,000 new COVID-19 infections, a six-month high for the city that is already in a state of emergency. In the capital, public viewing areas have been canceled. Bars have been asked not to serve alcohol. The torch relay, an Olympic mainstay, was replaced by online lighting ceremonies. So far, 87 people associated with the Olympics have tested positive for the virus. That includes several athletes whose Olympic dreams were cut short. Still, organizers have played down fears of a cluster infection breaking out in the Olympic Village. Besides COVID-19 fears, the Games also went massively over budget. Earlier this year, the head of the Tokyo Organizing Committee resigned following outrage over his comments that women talk too much. This week, the opening ceremony director was fired after footage emerged of him mocking the Holocaust in a 1998 comedy sketch. Jules Boykoff is a former Olympic athlete and author of several books on the Olympics.
As someone who's studied the political history of the Olympics, these really jump out at some wild times in terms of Olympics land.
Despite the controversy, organizers hope the focus will shift to sports once the competition begins. According to Gracenote, a data analytics company, the United States is projected to lead all countries with 96 medals, including 40 gold medals. It would be the seventh consecutive Summer Olympics in which the U.S. led the overall medal count. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
The World Health Organization is urging African countries to ramp up preparations for COVID-19 vaccination rollouts in anticipation of the imminent arrival of millions of vaccine doses on the continent. WHO reports more than 6.2 million people have been infected with COVID-19 on the continent, and more than 159,000 have died. Lisa Schneider reports for VOA from Geneva.
New cases of COVID-19 in Africa have fallen slightly following 8 weeks of a fast-moving surge. The decline is attributed to a sharp drop in cases in South Africa. However, the World Health Organization reports the situation could change quickly as violent protests and mass gatherings in the country could trigger another rise in cases. WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, says Africa's third wave is not over. She notes 21 countries, three more than last week, are experiencing a resurgence. She says the highly contagious Delta variant has now been detected in 26 countries, and 13 of them need more oxygen due to a surge in cases. She says Africa continues to lag in COVID-19 vaccines, with just 20 million Africans, or 1.5% of the continent's population, fully vaccinated. But she says Africa's supply crunch is starting to ease. She says the first delivery of doses donated by the United States through the COVAX facility is arriving in Africa this week. And altogether, nearly 60 million doses from other sources are expected in the coming weeks.
African countries must go all out and speed up their vaccine rollouts by 5 to 6 times if they are to get all these doses into arms and fully vaccinate the most vulnerable 10% of their people by the end of September. Around 3.5 to 4 million doses are administered each week on the continent, but this needs to rise to 21 million doses each week at the very least to meet this goal.
Moeti says more than half a billion doses are expected through COVAX alone this year. This massive influx, she says, means countries must up their game.
We need to address the issue of vaccine hesitancy. So this communication, targeting people, targeting the messages that we are tracking, and the misinformation or the fears and misconceptions is absolutely vital now, because the time to mobilize people to be ready to be vaccinated is not when the vaccines are landing. It is now in this narrow period of a window that we have to do all of this.
Regional Director Moeti says countries must scale up their operations. She says countries need sufficient vaccine sites, storage facilities, adequate transport, plans for distribution, and of course, health workers to carry out this life-saving activity. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Italian government Thursday adopted a new decree extending the country's COVID-19 state of emergency through December 31st and outlining new rules that go into effect August 6th aimed at curbing the spread of new infections. A COVID-19 Green Pass vaccine passport will be needed to get into Italian bars and restaurants, indoors, open-air shows, gyms, and meetings. The use of the pass on public transport in schools and in workplaces will be addressed next week. Sabina Casofranco reports from Rome.
Italy Thursday announced new anti-COVID-19 measures as infections have started to rise again, mainly due to the highly contagious Delta variant. The number of new coronavirus infections has doubled in the past week, with the country now recording more than 5,000 new cases daily. With fears that the number will continue to grow, Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi Thursday evening outlined new rules that will go into effect August 6. Draghi said the so-called Green Pass will be required in Italy for many services, including entertainment and leisure. The Green Pass certifies that an individual has received at least one vaccine dose, has tested negative in the last 48 hours, or has recently recovered from the virus. The rules make the Green Pass a requirement to eat in restaurants and bars and for outdoor sports events and museums, movie theatres, gyms, fairs and meetings. Draghi said Italy's economy is doing well and even growing more than other European countries. He said the Green Pass is essential to keep economic activity open so people can enjoy entertainment with the assurance they won't be next to contagious people. Health Minister Roberto Speranza said 40 million Italians already have their Green Pass, adding that vaccination is the way to put behind us the most difficult season that we have had to face. Draghi also appealed to Italians who have not yet received the vaccine to do so immediately to protect themselves and their families. L'appello a non vaccinarsi è un appello. He said calls for people to not get vaccinated are calls for people to die, because if you do not get vaccinated, you get sick and you die. Without vaccinations, everything must close again, he added. Draghi said that thanks to vaccinations, the consequences for intensive care units and deaths from COVID-19 have become much less serious. Further government discussions will be held beginning next week to decide whether Green Pass measures will be required for public transport, at schools and in workplaces. In the meantime, new parameters were adopted for how Italy's regions will change colour to indicate their level of COVID-19 risk. Their status will no longer be based on the number of infections, but on the number of people that are in hospitals and intensive care units being treated for COVID-19. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
The hometown of Haiti's slain president, Jovenel Moïse, is preparing to receive his body for a private funeral amid heavy security following violent demonstrations in the area. White t-shirt and cups emblazoned with his picture were distributed to supporters ahead of what is expected to be the final ceremony to honor Moïse. He was shot several times on July 7th during an attack at his private home that also seriously injured his wife, Martine. Friday's funeral comes a day after violent demonstrations hit neighborhood in Cape Haitian as groups of men fired shots into the air and blocked some roads with blazing tires. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great weekend.